Hello, and welcome to episode 86 of the Escape from Illustration Island podcast. This is Thomas James. You can find my illustration portfolio at thomasjamesillustration.com. But today, I'm super excited to share with you my conversation with John Flansburgh from the band They Might Be Giants, one of two founding members of the band, along with John Linnell. And I was really honored that John took the time to talk with me today. I know that, you know, he does tons of interviews, probably millions of interviews by now, related to They Might Be Giants. So I wanted to make a point of having a different kind of conversation with him, talk more about his history with the visual arts and design, and what he brings and wants to create for They Might Be Giants, and how they tie in the visuals and who they work with, and just the nature of creativity and collaboration. We cover a lot of ground, and he was very generous with his time and open and honest, as so many of my guests are, and I'm so honored to get to talk to him, not only as a fan of They Might Be Giants, but to get a chance to have his unique perspective on visual arts, illustration, and design, and how to communicate in that way. So, without any further delay, let's just go ahead and get to my conversation with John Flansburgh.
Check, check, check. Oh, yeah. Check, check, check. Check, check, check. Check, check, check. Oh, yeah. What are the hard-hitting questions?
Well, I think what I'd love to do, and, you know, and my hope is that I'm especially appreciative when someone like you comes on the show, who I know does no shortage of interviews and recorded conversations. And my hope is that we can do something a little different today than you might be used to.
Sure.
Hopefully that'll make it a little more interesting, because I'd like to dig a little deeper and talk about just about creativity and mm-hmm. Also tie in a lot of the visual stuff, because I know that you have a design background and you've been so involved in the visual aspect of things, and, you know, in all of the aspects of your own work and They Might Be Giants and things like that. So I think what I want to start with is to go kind of way back. And I know that you've mentioned in other interviews that you were heavily influenced by your father and his own artistic pursuits. So I wonder if you could maybe go back there and talk about your first experiences in when you first started feeling like you were someone who just wanted to create.
Well, you know, I think all the people who are interested in mid-century modernist stuff in general will sort of kind of lean a little closer to the speaker when they hear that I actually grew up in essentially a Bauhaus-styled house, like a completely capital M modernist house. And, you know, it was my father had designed this house. So it was, you know, very much a very direct expression of his interest and his ideas. But I have to say, in some ways, you know, when you're a kid, you don't ever think about yourself as being any different than anybody else, or you don't think of your situation as being different. But in retrospect, I feel like the influence of just the geometry that I lived in, and also just the amount of art supplies that were around me, it made it almost impossible for me not to kind of work with those notions. You know, that I was my whole domestic existence was kind of on a grid.
And so your father was not just an artist in as a profession, but it sounds like that was just all around you all the time. Is that true?
Right. I mean, he was, you know, he had gone to Cornell University. Both my parents were from Ithaca, New York, and he had gone to Cornell University for undergraduate in architecture. And that was very, you know, his father was a professor at Cornell. He was very much part of that institutional world. And then he had gone to MIT graduate school and had studied under Walter Gropius, and then moved out to Lincoln, where Walter Gropius's house is. And it was kind of an era, it was very, in some ways, this very Mad Men era, and there's some similarities to kind of now in Silicon Valley, I think, which is that their relationship to corporate America was much more okay. You know, there were a lot of think tanky kind of things. It was like the Rand Corporation was really in the mix, and the sort of the idea of cutting edge creative thought and corporate thought were not so different. You know, a company like IBM was like a brand new, very exciting kind of cool company. I mean, I remember when the IBM Selectric was wheeled into my father's firm. Everyone kind of gathered around and looked at it, and it was just like, oh, this is so weird. You know, the circular typing ball that flew around. It was a completely different way of typing. And then there was the Xerox machine, which was this amazing innovation of just, you know, being able to duplicate printed material. And these were things that just were total mind blowers to me. I mean, I guess process, you know, the truth is ultimately I would get a, you know, a BFA in printmaking, and I would become a graphic designer, which is kind of different than just being a painter or being an illustrator. It's like there's this whole process part of it that kind of runs parallel to my interest in tape recorders as along with musical instruments. I guess I enjoy thinking about the layers of image making and the layers of, you know, the layers of process in a creative endeavor.
Yeah, and so I think that it sounds to me, and it's something that I've wanted to talk to you about, it sounds like you're more interested just in just getting into whatever process is happening and really geeking out on that and just enjoying the creative process more than the product itself.
Well, you know, I guess, you know, when I mean, first I should say that, you know, when we started the MIP Giants, We were very much an independent band. I mean, we didn't have that many commercial prospects. I think we wanted to be as successful as we could be, but there were a lot of gatekeepers in the world, and being in a successful rock band really involved like a kind of careerism that we didn't know how much we were up for. So it was, we looked to other bands who were kind of DIY bands like The Residents specifically, who had a very strong identity. And I think if people don't know about The Residents, they should, you know, definitely look them up, because they're a very interesting singular kind of band. They were a faceless band, or they had this sort of enigmatic costumes that were sort of the avatars of their characters. But they were not, they didn't appear in the materials. I mean, this is all pre-rock video, and mm-hmm. and they so all you had to do is really have a satisfying album cover, and you had fulfilled your obligation to do something visually as a band. But I guess I mean I should well I'm sort of losing my own thread here, just like as the past is washing over me. But I think we, both John and I, in our collaboration, really felt like it would be a more interesting and more open-ended project if it wasn't identified with our faces, if it wasn't about our personas, that mm-hmm. it would give the listener more elbow room, or more just like room for their imagination to kind of think of They Might Be Giants as an experimental, as an imaginary world unto itself. Mm-hmm. And that was very appealing to us. And for us, it made us a lot less self-conscious about just kind of how attractive we were, how contemporary we were, or, you know, all the things about being in a rock band that seem kind of zeitgeisty. It's like we could sort of skip over the hipster component of it and just be in the imaginary world of our music. And I think that idea appealed to both of us completely. And having come from graphic design and having come from working in newspapers and magazines, I knew a lot of the things that were available to us besides just doing a photo shoot with our face, big old faces.
Right. But I think what's interesting is, I know that you made, you know, early on made your own recordings on a 4-track recorder, and you've done a lot of visual things, you've done video work, and do you feel like, are you the kind of person who's just hungry to create and And so that you dig into the process, no matter what it is, to fit whatever project.
Thomas, I'm just hungry all the time. I'm actually standing I'm 1 foot away from the four track recorder you're actually talking about. So it's funny when you mentioned it. I was like, well, it's still right here. Mm-hmm. I think we've been doing this for 35 years. It's safe to say that, you know, we enjoy our work.
Right. Well, I think the thing that I'm trying to get at here is another thing that you've mentioned is one reason you got a guitar was it was a conduit, or it was just a vehicle for creating the recordings you wanted to make. And so I think it's
right.
Interesting that it's somewhere along the way, there's just this insatiable urge. I need to create something now. And so I'm going to go to get a guitar, or I'm going to get a recorder, or I'm going to get a camera, or whatever it is. Even if it's DIY and you're taping things together, there's just like this insatiable urge. And I'm wondering how much of that came from your upbringing or if that's just in your DNA.
Right. I mean, it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. I guess just circling back to the idea of making recordings and making printed material, like there's this element of otherness, or like a making an object that's sort of apart from you that, part of what I'm not saying that I don't get like a personal gratification out of the pride of making something myself and feeling like I made that. Mm-hmm. But there is something different about the impulse to make something versus the impulse is different than the impulse of feeling cool about yourself. You know, and so it's like taking pride in creating something is kind of a different, and maybe it's a subtle thing, and maybe it doesn't matter to a lot of people. I mean, we live in this era where like everything is about fame and identity, and even people who don't even seem to be interested in making anything at all have this intense desire to be famous. I think for me, personally, I really enjoy the magical experience of making. And I remember taking a photography class and just going into doing the darkroom stuff for the first time, and the photograph coming up in the print enlarger, doing the enlargement and mm-hmm. making a photograph in the photographic bath. And that whole thing, I just thought, oh, this is the coolest thing that could possibly ever happen. You know, this is better than any magic show I've ever seen. You know, you take this, and you can kind of do it to almost anything. It's also exciting to kind of take something that's very simple and turn it into a new object. It's hard to describe, but that is definitely and where that impulse comes from. I really couldn't say. I can tell you that, you know, it's been as somebody who's, you know, I bought my first tape recorder when I was like 8 years old. So it's like and this was a time when people didn't buy tape recorders. So it must have seemed very strange to my parents. And I'm very happy and grateful that they sort of supported me in my mania for these very narrow paths that I went on. but that's me.
Before we go get a little more into some of the deeper stuff I want to talk about, I think it's important that we touch on what your actual design history is. So if you could walk us through maybe what made you decide to go down that route and what your general path was.
Well, I think like a lot of people who end up in the arts in general, in a way, the arts kind of found me. I was very reluctant. I never took art school seriously as an idea until I had basically belly flopped out of every other kind of school you could go to.
I think something that's interesting that I know that you've said, and a lot of people that I've interviewed have said, is that they didn't necessarily know what illustration was when they started going to school, or they didn't know what design was when they started going to school, and then they eventually figured it out, and then they were like, oh, this is what I've been wanting to do all along.
Well, I'm not trying to be contrary to that, because I think that is true. I just got finished reading Paul Sayre's. Paul Sayre has written a book about his sort of discovering his life as a designer, mm-hmm. and it's a memoir, and there's definitely a lot of surprise turns in the book in terms of that kind of self-discovery. But as I said, like growing up in the house I grew up in, I remember my father explaining to me what super graphics were, which was this sort of very 1970-71 idea of doing graphic design on the side of buildings, like doing oversized signage that was mm-hmm. kind of an expression of, I mean, it was basically an expression of Helvetica and 20 feet tall on the side of a wall in some kind of, you know, acid green color. And I just thought that was the coolest idea. I thought about being a graphic designer from a very early age. So it was almost like my fallback, doing design stuff. We live in a computer age, so like, you know, when you talk about graphic design, I think of like a world of waxers and stat machines and things that are all completely archaic. But growing up in the 60s, there were, when you read a textbook, it was all like probably done like in some, you know, fontographic kind of output thing. It was hard to say what exactly, how they were made, but they're made very crudely, just in kind of in the same way they are now. But one thing that was very clear is that there'd be pieces of printed material that would be patched in, and because the size of the type or the weight of the type would change because there wasn't a lot of consistency with the way the output worked. Mm-hmm. And I remember being 6 years old and being very excited to be able to identify what a patch was on a textbook. Uh-huh. So, which is, you know, speaking of somebody who's like a really terrible student, I feel like it's really one of those, like, I was really grooving on the trees and not the forest. You know, I really could have been a better reader, but unfortunately, I was too busy staring at the shapes of the graphic design. I loved all this stuff, but I kind of didn't take it seriously, and I don't think I took art school as a culture very seriously. I was not a careerist, I had done graphic design. I worked on my high school newspaper. I had worked doing layout stuff. I worked in the graphic design department of my father's office when I was in high school as a summer job. So I was always aware that it was a thing that was, you know, design was really an occupation, but I just wasn't that particularly interested in sort of following in my father's shoes, I guess, was part of my identity was just being independent of that, and that mm-hmm. seemed to be a little bit of an overlap. So maybe I just avoided it for a long time. But I did go to art school. I went to art school for fine arts. I got in, I basically snuck into Pratt as a transfer student, and got in with a commercial art portfolio, which is much easier to transfer into Pratt than it is. I could never have applied and gotten in with the grades I had or the portfolio that I had. But as a transfer student, I got a kind of a free pass, and went through the foundation year there in fine arts, and then basically just completely pursued fine art printmaking, you know, old-fashioned lithography and all that other process stuff, and really enjoyed it. And in terms of transferable skills, really kind of discovered how to be a songwriter through the discipline of the art program there, because, you know, you when you go through that kind of boot camp experience, one thing, you know, you learn pretty early on is if you try to do something 10 times, the 10th time you do it, you'll be a lot better at it than the first time, which is, I think, kind of some, you know, seems kind of obvious, but I mean, I really actually felt like I got my money's worth when they taught me that.
So that's interesting. You were going for more visual arts, and but you're saying it had an effect on your songwriting. Could you explain a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Well, you know, I had this four-track tape recorder when I was a teenager, but I was not a musician. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the punk rock era happened. The 1977 happened, and you know, what people would now think of as kind of new wave 70s music was happening. And it really had a very basic effect on me. It was very much like Amnesty Day. I loved music, but I did not consider myself capable of being a musician or capable of being a kind of a pop songwriter. In part because, you know, as a child, like the most popular bands were like the Beatles and James Brown, and then later on, you know, things like Elton John and stuff like that. So there's sort of a superhero quality to a lot of performers, and that wasn't what mere mortal people could do. Mm-hmm. And so it was like the new wave thing was like an Amnesty Day. I could see myself just as easily have in a different time just becoming a DJ and thinking like, well, that's sort of an expression of my love of music. But when punk rock hit, it really kind of took over everything, and there was a visual aesthetic to it as well, and I just felt like you know, I wasn't interested in classical music, I wasn't interested in harmony, I was interested in the visceral part of the rock music experience, and going to art school had some great side effects on that, but it was mm-hmm. it was really just a parallel interest. But in the history of people's lives, a lot of things you can be doing two things at the same time, and their influence over each other is very direct, but it's hard to even say exactly.
Right.
I skipped the years of therapy to figure that out.
Okay, so after school, what happened with where did you go with your design work?
Well, you know, the band sort of started taking off in my last year of Pratt. I worked as in the planning office of Metro North. I counted people on getting onto commuter trains for a couple of years as I finished my degree at Pratt, and then we started the band at that exact same time, and then I just started working at magazines. I started working in publishing in New York, like on Third Avenue, where there, I'm sure there's some version of it now, but it was like Macmillan had this gigantic building. I worked for Macmillan Educational for a while in graphic design, just laying out these children's books. So I was sort of back to where I was when I was six. Like I was literally doing patches on books.
For some other kid to notice and geek out on.
Exactly. So it all came full circle, it was a real machine. We would put out hundreds of pages of printed material a week. We were doing these workbooks for teachers. It was very lo-fi stuff, and then I slowly kind of marched up the graphic design kind of back office stuff. I worked for Random House for a while. I did paste up for like the Cat in the Hat for Dr. Seuss. I did a bunch of stuff for them, and it's a very different time. You know, it was much, things were much more physical, and it took a lot more hands on deck to do. I think these days a magazine might have one designer or two designers, and they lay out the whole magazine. When I was at Self Magazine, there were probably 12 full-time layout people.
Yeah, and speaking of how different things were then, it reminds me of something you've said in another interview where you mentioned that, in your opinion, you thought, and maybe this was just an offhand thing and you don't believe it, but you had said that you thought maybe there was like a whole category of effects or visual things that disappeared when Photoshop came along. And so I wonder if you could expand on that or just the things that you feel may have been lost or just turned away from by, you know, embracing digital and things like that?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, as time has gone on, there's, the digital stuff has kind of clawed back a lot of the things that fell off the back of the truck at first. I mean, the same is true of digital audio. There are a lot of tools that people would take advantage of because they were working in with one set of tools, and then when they were gone, they sort of figured out how to get by without them. But ultimately, I mean, things just like when I think of the way things were screened and rescreened, there's definitely sort of optical effects that you can do on a stat machine or with photography that if you really know what you're doing, you can kind of get to things that are a little bit more exciting. But this involves, you know, technical support. When I think about a stat room basically has a machine the size of an elephant in the middle of it. it doesn't seem quite as practical as working off your laptop.
You have mentioned that, you know, They Might Be Giants was formed around this time. And I think that kind of goes into something that I'd really like to ask you about. And that is, the word collaboration comes to mind, but it seems to me to be a little deeper than that. And, I draw kind of a parallel to my own life. I have a best friend since high school. And a side note, his name is Jason Ritz. He's a bigger fan of They Might Be Giants. And there are some reasons that he should probably be doing this interview rather than me. But over the years, he has turned me on to how great They Might Be Giants is and the things that you guys have done and the breadth and just the level of how prolific you guys have been. But I think the thing that's interesting is that my friend and I have been not only best friends, but creative collaborators over the years. We've collaborated on music and art and visuals. And I know that he's the kind of person that I can go to with a crazy idea, like doing a rap song, and he'll do it because I asked him to. And so I think I've come to realize over the years just how rare that is to have someone who, to me, I consider a creative brother. And it's just a really special level of collaboration with someone. And it certainly seems like you've have that with John Linnell. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that's been like to have that kind of a level of a collaborator.
Well, it can be very intense. I think John and I enjoy something that's sort of akin to good timing. I mean, he moved to the town I was living in when he was 8 years old, but we really grew up in the same kind of historical moment of the hippie culture and counterculture stuff in kind of a progressive Massachusetts liberal world. And we saw a lot of the exact same rock shows at the exact same time. We saw a lot of, we saw underground comics at the same time. We saw underground movies at the same time. You know, I think I saw Mean Streets with John Linnell. Like, you know, it's just, there were so many formative cultural things that we went through at the exact same time and kind of in the exact same way that and we had the same high school teachers. You know, we had, in so many ways, we are like brothers, but we don't have the stressors of having to, you know, get through the same parents or get through, the same family scenarios. It's like we don't have to find any other kind of common ground. We just get to enjoy each other's company, and yet we have all this kind of parallel history, and that makes things. That makes I think what makes it very easy to be in a band for so long. I mean, most bands last 5 years. I've been in this band for 35 years. Is that we kind of have the same values in terms of what we want out of it. Like when I was saying, we didn't really want to put our faces on it. It wasn't like one of us was reluctant to put our face on it. The other one didn't mind. It's like we both had the exact same feeling that it would be a better strategy to just kind of figure out a more creative package solution to the image of the band than it just being about our faces. And that that makes a lot of, you can make a lot of really bold decisions if you really are coming from a similar place. And there are only two of us. So it's like, it's not like we have to accommodate the fifth guy who's got some crazy idea. You know what I mean? So we were very streamlined, and it was very easy to kind of make more extreme decisions.
But I think it's interesting that you also use the word intense. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you know, John has been, I mean, I don't want to speak for John too much, but you know, he had been in a band, he had been the sideman in a band that was very professionally ambitious. And although it wasn't something that was like talked about too much, and they were a very, really top quality band. They were like an art school band out of RISD called the Mundanes, and they were very much in that sort of new wave, skinny tie-ish moment of power pop. And they were a top quality band. I saw a million of their shows. I learned a lot of things about being in a band from watching them as a band. But they kind of arrived in New York a couple of days late to really have things happen for them. It was like 1980-81, and the punk rock thing, the power pop thing, the new wave thing had kind of ebbed. So I think John wanted to do something that was just for fun. I think we sort of decided very early on that we wanted to just sort of invest ourselves into this thing that no matter how short or long it lasted, it would just be interesting while it was happening, which is a really different thing than saying, like, I'm going to give this band professionally a year or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, most people are in a really big hurry to get somewhere and do something important in their lives. And I think we, just by temperament, were kind of the opposite of that. I think we were really trying to figure out how to just do something that was interesting for ourselves. And I don't think we had that much confidence that it would speak to that many people. You know, most of the music we were interested in seemed kind of on the outside looking out. Mm-hmm. You know, bands like The Residents or a band like Tere Ubu, these were bands that really loomed large at the moment. And also, in the New York scene, at the exact moment that we started, was very preoccupied with this no wave movement, which I have to say is one of the slenderest threads in the history of New York City musical scenes, because it was entirely unloved by the general public. I found it kind of fascinating, but the artists, like the bands and that broke out of that scene, like James Chance or you know, James White and the Blacks or DNA or Lydia Lunch, or those acts, you know, I mean, I guess they're sort of the predecessors of Sonic Youth and Swans and a lot of Glenn Branca-ish stuff, but it was really ugly kind of performance art stuff that just audiences kind of cowered from. You know, it just was not loved. And so it was a very anti-commercial moment anyway. I have to tell you, like, the very first show we ever did, I was very surprised at how much it seemed like we were actually communicating with, or the audience was kind of understanding what we were doing with our mm-hmm. songs. Like, I figured we would not get a lot of applause, and I sort of figured we would not, and I certainly didn't think people would laugh. and all that happened, you know, it seemed like people related to what we were doing quite completely right off the bat, which was a huge surprise to me.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of building on the collaboration topic. Obviously, we mentioned that I spoke with Paul Serre recently for the podcast, and I know you guys mm-hmm. have done a lot of work together. And my conversation with him was really great. It was kind of like a typical conversation, but as soon as the conversation got to his work with They Might Be Giants, it was almost like he took a shot of Red Bull and he was like a kid in a candy store. He got so excited to be talking about it. I'd love to hear about your experience working with Paul Serre, and I know that we're jumping forward quite a bit, but it's just
forward exactly 25 years, I think. But that's okay. I mean, the truth is you know, They Might Be Giants is a project, as I said, like, we decided we weren't going to put our photograph on the cover of our records, and that meant that and I was not going to put my own personal visual art on the records because I felt, or Linnell's visual art on the records, because I felt like that would make it seem like a vanity project. Mm-hmm. So immediately, in the same way that, like, you know, say Smith's albums have a different thing about, you know, a different historical photo figure on every album cover, for us it was like we're going to find a different way to do an album cover every time and not have it be just another parallel thing. So, you know, our first album cover had an illustration by Rodney Allen Greenblatt, who was an East Village artist. Our second album had this shrine that was built by our friend Brian Dewan, who had lots of unusual original ideas. Our third album was a photograph from Life magazine that had never, from their archive, that had never been printed. And then onward. So we worked with a lot of illustrators, millions of graphic designers over those years. And I became kind of, became very good at making cold calls. If I saw somebody whose work that I liked, I would sort of try to investigate more about them. Through the miracle of the internet, you can kind of get a much deeper dive into people's work very quickly. And I had seen Paul's stuff in the New York Times a bunch and had kind of taken note of how, like, super... I think at the time that I first talked to him, he was doing a lot of stuff that looked almost like pop art, in this very high contrast, or sort of some kind of agitprop. You have like a black and white photograph on this crazy bright color field. Mm-hmm. And then when I kind of did my due diligence, I realized, oh, this guy has been, you know, he started with M and Company, and he's been on the scene for all this time, and he's still doing stuff that's catching my eye. I was like, you know, I bet this guy would be, you know, have some interesting ideas. And when I called him up, he just, you know, I don't know if he just saw the opportunity to do kind of more open-ended stuff, but he just, or maybe, you know, he probably comes at everything this way, but he just was like, I'm glad you called. I have 1,000 really interesting ideas to throw at you. Just give me 45 minutes and I will overwhelm your inbox with WeTransfer stuff. And it was great. I mean, I feel like, to be perfectly honest, I am so used to exhausting illustrators and exhausting graphic designers. I have had, you know, we're not the wealthiest band in the world, and we don't have the biggest budgets in the world. And I ask a lot of questions, and I don't tend to make a ton of revisions, but I tend to make the revisions that make people groan. And Paul has been up for all of it, and I'm just so happy that he still can, you know, bring that level of enthusiasm, you know, low these 10 years.
I'm going to ask you to articulate maybe the impossible, and that is, or at least speak to how you think of the visual side of what you guys create with They Might Be Giants, and how that how that goes along with the audio.
Well, when we first started, we thought of a lot of the visual stuff as kind of reflecting our background together, as that there was this obvious nostalgia aspect to it, and then there was this kind of maybe with a dash of enigmatic flair, like something unknowable kind of tossed in to it. I think part of what we were doing was trying to just not, just literally try to make something that is uncategorizable as a way, kind of getting back to that idea of not, it's just nice to not pigeonhole yourself.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, I don't have that many conversations like this, so it's a little, sometimes parts of this are hard for me to even talk about. But one thing that I kind of came up in a Q&A thing after I did an interview with Debbie Millman a couple of years ago, and in the Q&A we were talking about different things, and I realized that one very conspicuous thing that we have avoided by and large is we have never really done things that were retro, which is strange because, you know, as I said, like, there is this backwards looking aspect to our music. Our music has sort of elements of pastiche in it, and we're not afraid to make things sound like established styles, and we do have this shared history together. But there's something about retro design that always, as much as I love it, and I really do, I do find the history of design fascinating, and I enjoy retro design a lot when it's well done. But it just seems like, how can something be really new if it's just a cultural reference to something else?
Right.
And so, I mean, that's part of my thinking.
And I know that you've mentioned mystery quite a few times, and you like to kind of have, especially at least with the album covers, you talked about them almost more as something you could dig into and to discover in your own way, rather than, again, what we talked about, not being a literal representation of anything, right?
Yeah, I think maybe this is really coming out of being a child of the 60s and having this very visceral experience with a record album as a piece of physical stuff. It really is, people talk about vinyl records a lot, and they talk about how the music sounds on the records, but let's face it, the thing that's really great about vinyl records is the covers.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just, it's a great package. It's like, it is very seldom, think of the vinyl album as, it's like the book 2.0, you know, what's a really good idea? A book, you know, it's way better than a scroll. Scrolls are okay, but scrolls are not how you want to read. You want to read things from a book. And how do you want to listen to music? You want to have like this big honking thing in your hands that is just an exciting, open invitation to explore this music. And you know, I'm excited by biography. I'm excited by photographs of people's faces as much as anybody else. I do like traditional album covers that just have this Marlene Dietrich album cover that actually has no type on it at all, and it's just her, you know, it's just Marlene Dietrich's extremely vivid face and kind of like a Technicolor photograph, and it's extraordinarily striking. You know, it's just wow. You know, that is the most Marlene Dietrich-y thing you can have, is full, you know, her face just staring straight at you. So I feel like it's a great platform. You know, the album cover is a very exciting platform for graphic expression. It's almost ideal in terms of its, and with a vinyl album cover, it's like its scale, its directness, it's just a very monolithic, powerful way to get a graphic image into the world. And I just think it's exciting.
And speaking of all this, how has the approach to visuals, and especially when you come to album art, how has that changed with, you know, now things are reduced to often a thumbnail image on a computer, whereas before right. It was so much more physical. How is your approach to how you guys present yourselves visually? How's that changed because of that?
Well, it sort of just kind of makes even more demands on what the design challenge is. I've had lots of conversations with people about how it would be nice if we can figure out a way to make the name of the band be legible in the thumbnail, because when it's not, or if it just looks like a mini, you kind of lose something. But it's hard to sneak that in. I should also say one thing that people, I mean, since almost everyone listening is probably younger than me, there was this tyranny of even in the CD era, of the album, the band name and the album title having to be along the top of the record for years. I mean, basically from the 70s on, people realized that everyone's just flipping through these crates.
Right.
And if the name isn't on the top, then people won't know what it is. And if you were an indie band kind of trying to claw your way to the middle, it was definitely something where you were doing yourself a huge disservice not putting your name at the top of the thing. But you know, these are, you know, I mean, that's not a design challenge, that's more just like a preset. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a sad state of affairs that you feel like, if you feel like you have to create a design with the title of the band at the top.
Right.
But when I think back of our first couple of records, all we were doing is just going like, okay, got it, got the memo. Okay, there you go. Band name on top. You know, we hate this. We did it. Fine. Deal, you know, whatever.
We'll make Moving the rest on. Of the album cover cool.
Right. Exactly. We just got over ourselves and did it.
So I know you're busy, so I want to let you go soon, but one thing that I definitely want to make sure I ask you about is that I think They Might Be Giants, I feel like you guys have a reputation for not only being very prolific, but consistently, you still have a consistent quality of work while also being prolific, and so it might seem like on the outside, you guys just kind of have the golden touch and everything comes easy. But I would wonder if you would be able to speak to any kind of creative struggle that you've had in your life or career, and something that you've had to overcome, and what you took away from that.
I really thought the first thing you were going to say is you have a reputation for being hard to work with.
Do you?
You know, do we? I probably. You know, I think so. I think a lot of people have a little bit of reputation for being hard to work with. I mean, it's not like you know, we've worked with a lot of the same people for forever. I mean, we've worked with the same engineer for 27 years. You know, so I mean, we've had the same manager for 35 years. We've had the same booking agent. I mean, we can't be that hard to work with. But I think the truth is, it's like any really kind of high voltage creative enterprise has got something about it that you know, you we do a lot of things that we don't work with people by mistake. That is probably the secret to the success of our collaborations. It's like we've had very good luck finding all sorts of people. Like when I think of somebody like David Coles, who is like, David Coles has done the illustration for probably 25 videos that we've made over the past 20 years. He was really a key part of all the kids stuff that we did. Like he did many different looks and many different styles. He's very, he can really change his style in a very fluid way. He did the Mesopotamians video, which is very much one thing, but he also did a video for like Icky that's got a completely Photoshop-y kind of look to it. You know, so he really moves around as an illustrator from very handmade stuff to very tight photographic photo collage, motion graphic stuff. And he can just do that. And I know him, but he's not, he lives in Buffalo, New York. He's far away. It's just one of those email collaborations. Mm-hmm. But you know, he's great, and he's just got lots of different skills and is up for all sorts of different stuff. And I feel like we've worked with so many different people over the years who've just brought everything that they could bring to what we were doing and made us look like we really have our scene together because of it, you know. But in terms of like the creative challenge for what we're doing, it's, you know, we work a lot, you know. I don't think there's a single song that we've worked on that has only taken a day. So it's not like we just sort of bash out a song and you know, give each other high fives and then we're done. It's like everything is kind of a process. And there have been a couple times where we've actually completely run aground. When we started making Join Us, which was the first project that we worked on with Paul, mm-hmm. we had recorded without too much touring in between. We had basically recorded three albums in a row, and because we were in the midst of a very successful run with Disney doing these kids projects, and mm-hmm. suddenly we'd won a Grammy, and so there was this like very real kind of demand for just putting out more stuff or putting out stuff every year. And when you're putting out a DVD with 45 minutes of animation and 45 minutes of original songs, the original recordings, it's just, you know, that's just about, I mean, that is a full-time job. I mean, you're going to be working on that for most weeks in the year. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that, I mean, we don't really, as I say, like, I don't do this kind of interview very often, and I really don't talk about process very much, but I think the thing that people might be surprised by, when you think about somebody being prolific, you kind of think of them as just being extremely gifted. You know, I think when I think about Prince, I just think like, oh, well, you know, he was obviously struck by lightning at a very early age and has supernatural skills. I don't want to say that, like, we aren't really good at our jobs and don't have great imaginations and all that. But there is this other aspect to what we're doing, which is just like doing the work, actually just sitting down and every day and working on stuff in a kind of piecemeal, crafty way. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, that's our secret strategy, is just working a little harder than most people who want to be in a rock band.
And you do treat it like a job, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a job. Yeah, like a really good job. I mean, I've had really bad jobs in my life, so I know what a good one is. But
right.
But yeah, it's kind of like a job. I don't know. I mean, the truth is, I don't think people tend to want to be in a rock band because they're trying to figure out how to work particularly hard.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think another thing that was amusing that Paul Sarah had mentioned, and I think that maybe this goes along with being prolific, but he said that you'll get yourself talking about working with you on specifically something like Dial a Song, for example. You'll commit I'm going to do a video for every one of these songs, and it's not just going to be, you know, something simple I'm throwing up. You know, naturally, as a creator, you can't help yourself but want to make something awesome for everything. And so it's like natural overcommitting, I guess.
Yeah. And at different times, Paul, it's, you know, I feel like I've held back Paul, and other times Paul has held me back. So it's like it is one of those things where everything like that does seem like an open invitation to make something bigger than just a place marker project.
Right.
It's hard to keep things simple. Mm-hmm. If you're an excitable sort.
Right. Okay, so well, would you mind closing out by telling us maybe some things that either you're working on right now or kind of rolling around in your creative brain that are kind of on your creative focus right now?
Well, let's see. I just recently purchased this device called Ableton Push, and I'm sure many people are familiar with Ableton Live, which is like a computer program that's sort of like GarageBand 2.0. It's like a sequencer. It sort of turns playing loops into a game of Tetris, where you can kind of line up a bass line and line up a bar of drums playing in a loop and kind of really map out an arrangement very, very quickly. They've just made this thing called Ableton Push that I'm not really sure of the technology that is used to do what it does, but basically you can import any music file into it, and it will basically turn that 5-minute piece of musical program into 36 or less or more samples. So it can be either beat-based, which for a DJ would be like this intense, all of a sudden you instantly have all the pieces of the song dissembled into what would be like, oh, here's the killer breakbeat, you know.
Right.
So it's like, you don't even have to,
wow,
you don't even have to edit it, you don't have to do anything to it, it's just good to go. It knows what you're, it kind of has an idea of what most people are going for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, so that sort of beat preset for a DJ type person or a techno person is just this massive time saver, because you can just grab things from anywhere. And then once you grab it, you can stretch it in every way imaginable with all the sort of built-in things. It's like a closed system. It's its own physical. It's interesting because in 2017, you don't think of what a physical thing can do, but this is like a box. It's like the size of like an old-fashioned drum machine. It's or even bigger, and it has it actually has its own proprietary knobs that do all these very proprietary things. But the other thing it does that's hard to describe, but is fascinating to hear, is it will also take this piece of music and just pick out hits at of the music, basically peak moments of transience, like where the program is at its loudest,
uh-huh,
and just start at any loud section, and then every time you hit it, it's sort of triggering like that moment. And all of a sudden, you have 36 different moments in the song that you can just trigger. And when you start playing this like a drum pad or just like a sequencing pad what it offers up is so far away from the material that you've put in and sounds so totally weird. I wouldn't say it's a new kind of music, because it really is just a new kind of technology, but it is a very startling device. Not since like I bought my first Casio prosumer sampler have I had a thing where I was like, this thing is nuts.
it puts out things that you wouldn't normally be able to create on your own as a human, right?
Oh, it's completely about its own process. Like, there's nothing about it. It is not the product of anyone's imagination. You know, it is really just this machine that makes crazy sounds, and you just have to kind of ride the wild surf of its output.
Uh-huh.
But it's a neat thing.
And so are you just kind of playing around with it at this point, or are you trying to make
things with it? I'm just trying to figure out how to make a song out of it.
Uh-huh. All right, well, that sounds super fun. Thank you so much, John, for taking some time and so generously sharing your thoughts and digging into a kind of conversation that you normally maybe don't have. So,
yeah, it was a total gas. And
awesome.
Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your interest in what we're doing, and I look forward to checking out the the podcast.
Definitely. Yeah, I'll send it to you. And I don't know if I mentioned before, but I make a original, you know, original song for every guest. It's a 20-second song or something. So I'll send you that as well.
Oh, I cannot wait.
So thanks again, John. And yeah, I'll be in touch with you soon.
All right. So long.
Take care.